Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back. I'm Chris Temple, of course, and this is being recorded on Friday afternoon, late in the day after the market close, February 7th, 2025. And we're going to do a couple of different things today. First off, I want to take a quick lap through my favorite commodity stories as I've been talking about them for a while for 2025. One surprise that surfaced in the recent past, too, to kind of add to that, which had been one of my favorites last year, and maybe is going to have to be one again. We'll find out. And then after that, I'm going to bring on this episode's special guest, my old friend Curtis Moore. He's the Senior Vice President of Energy Fuels, and they just put out some news back on the 29th of January, so just a little over a week ago. That's something that we've all been waiting for quite a long time for. It's going to really transform their story, and I think really cause the markets to re-embrace energy fuels story again, where the uranium part of it at least is concerned, because that's something that's kind of been pushed off to the side by the markets in recent months for a few different reasons, some good, some bad. But we'll get to Curtis in just a minute. But first of all, I've expressed numerous times in probably the last 3 months, or give or take a little bit, my views that my three favorite commodity stories for the early days, at least, of Trump 2.0, our number one, gold, and silver kind of dragged along with it from time to time. Secondly, natural gas specifically, and the old energy themes of oil and gas generally. I'm going to give you a little bit of an update on that in this episode. Number three, of course, is a segue into my discussion with Curtis. We're going to talk about uranium, which has still kind of been flatlining around $70 a pound on a spot price, give or take. But that really doesn't tell the long-term story of where nuclear energy and uranium are going, in my view. Where gold is concerned to start with, as those of you watching the video version of this can see here on the screen, we have once again in this past week hit a new all-time high for the gold price in U.S. dollar terms. Of course, the gold price has been hitting nominal new highs in terms of numerous other currencies in the recent past, not as much so necessarily against the U.S. dollar, which has been pretty much the king of the hill among fiat currencies for a while now, as I've been discussing in recent months. But we finally got that breakout again in U.S. dollar terms. On the spot price, fell just a little bit shy of $2,900 an ounce. A couple of the forward contracts, I think the April contract that CNBC, among others, quotes, was a bit over $2,900. Sell it back a little bit today. Silver was pushing $33. It corrected a bit more today on Friday to close nearer $32 an ounce. But the big story with gold continues to be that it is, as I've pointed out numerous times in my own interviews, on this podcast with other people, it's really marching to its own tune. It's not necessarily correlated against anything. It is being used increasingly as a crisis hedge, as a hedge against uncertainty. I think inflation hedge again is creeping into the gold price. After all, some of the news today that caused a positive early look for the stock market to turn south quickly about mid-morning was when consumer sentiment figures came out, and they were decidedly downbeat, showing that consumers not only are their most pessimistic in the last several months, but more so that their outlook for inflation from their standpoint is as high as it's been in going on 2 years. That, of course, is something that Fire Marshal Jay, the Fed chairman, is always saying is not happening. He thinks inflation expectations are well anchored. I don't know what kind of anchor he's talking about, but the fact is that the average consumer is not feeling that. The average consumer thinks that inflation in the next year is going to be well above 4%. And again, that's the highest forecast put out by consumers in their own habits in about the last nearly 2 years. Now, gold is still a minefield. A lot of gold stories are not participating. Some of you who have already seen my video version of This Is Still Not Your Father's Gold Market understand the reasons why. If you've not seen that before, I encourage you to do it for a whole host of reasons. You need to know the right ways and the wrong ways to take advantage of both gold and silver. I mentioned a minute ago that there's kind of a metal coming up on the outside. That has been copper, which is kind of on a QT almost, although it made a bigger splash this week, has up about 12 or 13% in price for this year. And I would have thought, and was correct in this until recent days, that copper was going to stay somewhat dormant, maybe flatline along with most other base metals, over what are legitimate fears of perhaps the U.S. economy is finally going to slow down and join the rest of the world. If any of these tariff fears are realized, some of them, of course, on hold this week, thanks to the president giving both Canada and Mexico a 30-day reprieve until he decides what he's going to do longer term. But beyond that, you look at China, of course, and its economic problems besides the worries over tariffs. That's something that has kept most industrial commodities and industrial stories kind of on the back foot for a while. But seemingly, all of a sudden, what we're seeing happen again, and this happened last spring, I think, was when we saw a peak in the copper price to a then record of well over $5 a pound U.S. The shortage part of that story, I think, is being embraced again. There's been a couple bits of news recently, I'll be talking more about them in the days ahead, that underscore the fact that long term there is a massive lack of supply structurally with copper. There just is not enough copper to go around with all the different needs the world has, not just for energy, but for infrastructure and so forth, and not nearly enough new mine development and mines in the development stage that are going to be producing in time as well that are going to fill that gap. So that's something that bears watching. I still think it's a little bit suspect, but it's encouraging for people who have got some good long-term copper stories. Of course, we have a few of them, several of them indeed, with the National Investor, even though I like them more for their individual stories, and I'm still not quite sold yet that we need to jump into copper with both feet, but that's something I'll be looking at in the days ahead. And of course, it will depend a lot on the macro situation and how well the global economy stays together or alternatively does not. Number two after gold, and maybe 1A for gold and 1B for silver, we've got the old energy. Natural gas was a favorite story of mine for a while. A few weeks back when we were near the peak at a bit over $4 per MCF for natural gas, I advised our paid members with a National Investor to sell the ETFs that we had that were languishing for a while, but were all of a sudden they went up like a house of fire, and we ended up with decent profits on those. Natural gas, of course, has corrected from over $4 to, I think it was $3.30-ish or so, for those watching by video. Again, I'll have a chart on the screen here of that. The bigger story, I think, recently, and I'm going to get back to natural gas in a minute, but the bigger story recently has been what a lot of people are shaking their heads over, and that's been the abysmal performance of the crude oil price, which seems to have taken over maybe from copper as the economic worry wart among industrial-related commodities. Just like copper, of course, oil can be sensitive to fears over an economic slowdown and whatnot. But quite honestly, and I'm going to be talking more about this in a new issue to the National Investor going out in the next few days, along with some updates on our recommended companies there, which I think are, pretty much all of them still long-term screaming buys, with the exception of the pipelines, which have had incredible runs. I mean, these have been cash machines for us. I'm wondering if they're getting a little bit long in the tooth. That's a story for maybe next time. But crude oil itself, you would think that we're already in a global recession. And yet, everywhere you look on planet Earth, we are still, when you add it all up, at record consumption and demand levels. The supply situation I think, is much more supportive of a price, you know, $10 or $15 higher than it is right now. One of the energy-specific people that I follow is Eric Nuttall from Canada. I follow also Phil Flynn, of course, my friend here from the U.S. in the Chicago area. Both of them and several other ones that I've been paying attention to are looking at this and just scratching their head. Why is the price? I mean, we were threatening yesterday to go back below $70 a barrel on a WTI contract. It rallied a little bit today, so we ended up the week north of $70. But again, I think that the demand side has been completely neglected by a lot of traders that are out there in the markets. Now, hedge funds, and this is an interesting situation. A lot of hedge funds are still long oil. The directional traders in commodity markets have been shorting it because of worries about how much the new and improved tariffs, if you will, are going to hit demand globally for a lot of things and cause a reduction in usage and therefore validate what's already a low a price that would reflect a scenario like that. So look, I think long term that both oil and natural gas are looking great. I especially like the rebound potential down the road for natural gas. I think we've gotten all we're going to see out of the natural gas price to do with the weather this winter. And that was, of course, a lot of what drove the big gains that we saw in the early part of the year until a week or two ago. And that being that after a couple of abnormally mild winters in both Europe and the U.S., winter finally decided to show up this year. And that quickly changed the equation from surpluses and from storage running well above the five-year average to, you know, going down to the five-year average, and then by some measures recently a bit below that. Europe, even more so, has gone through a lot of the gas that they had in storage. The longer-term picture, though, I think is still great, and if you didn't see it, I'm going to put the links on the show notes here so you can get at least the publicly available snippets from his interview today, but the newly minted Trump Energy Secretary Chris Wright was interviewed on CNBC today, and he had a lot to say about natural gas. He had a lot to say about energy generally. I think a lot of what he's got his up his sleeve is spot on for where we're at as a country and what we need. One of the points he made was that going forward, there is still, as far ahead as you want to look for the time being, the single biggest demand part for electricity and utilities in the U.S. is going to be driven by natural gas, perhaps proportionally more so than what we've seen build in recent years, where natural gas has slowly been taking over largely the share of electricity production that coal used to provide. So natural gas is going to be a big one going forward, he has pointed out. And this really flies in the face of just the asinine action that New York State has taken recently. They're going to try and penalize companies operating in New York in one way or the other for their alleged harm to the environment. They're going to have retroactive taxes and whatnot. Again, we've got some people who, you know, the adults aren't back in a room everywhere yet when it comes to energy and things like that. And what Wright correctly pointed out is that in recent years, when you look at, and those of you who follow this subject know this already, the U.S. has led the world in reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, reduction of carbon, and so forth. Wright pointed out that if you look at the next seven countries combined that have been able to reduce carbon emissions over the last 20 years, the seven of them together don't equal the reduction in carbon and greenhouse gas emissions that the U.S. has already done. And that overwhelmingly, if you look at the reasons for the greenhouse gas emission reductions, that has been led chiefly by the increased adoption of natural gas, which is going to increase as time goes on. In fact, he pointed out that if you look at the Biden administration's priorities and the $4 trillion that has been invested to account for all of 3%, you know, of the total of electricity being, you know, batteries and solar and wind power and so forth. He said if you can look at the last 20 years, and it's the worst malinvestment driven by government policy of anything in recorded history. So we have gotten so little and spent so much on sources of electricity that are not reliable 24/7. There's still a time and a place, I suppose, for solar and wind power, especially on a small scale. I know a lot. I've got friends who have their own homes that are, you know, where it's possible and logistically easy to do this, that are driven by solar power. God bless them. That's great. You should do the same thing, I suppose, with wind. But when you're talking about public needs and power grid needs, these things do not pay for themselves over time. And so natural gas is going to continue to be a big and probably growing part of the mix of all of our electricity needs. And coming up after that on the outside, of course, is nuclear energy, which Chris Wright is very bullish on. He's delighted to see that private money, to a great extent, is going to be driving the increased uptake of nuclear energy. You look at the deal with, I think it was Microsoft over Three Mile Island. They're going to bring back one of the reactors into production and usage that was not damaged in that accident back a generation or so ago. So nuclear energy has got a great bright future as well. And here again, something that it's basically its only byproduct is water vapor that goes up the stacks of a typical nuclear plant. So look, there's a lot of great things that have already been done by U.S. industry, U.S. ingenuity. There's going to be more of it done. You know, I think that going forward, one of the reasons I have to add here, however, that I'm bullish on oil at the present price, as well as on natural gas after about a 20% drop from its peak price of about a month or so ago, is that demand continues to grow. And supplies really aren't set to grow with them in either case, certainly not at current prices for these things. And this is where, and I was exchanging messages this morning with a colleague of mine who is quite close to the Trump administration. And, you know, he tacitly agreed with me on a certain point. He's not going to say it publicly. But the idea that more recently Trump's Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, is floating, and that is we're going to bring inflation down with his 3-3-3 program. We're going to reduce the deficit to 3% of GDP, and another part of that is that we're going to increase oil production by 3 million barrels a day. Well, sorry, that part of this 3-3-3 program can't logistically happen. I've talked about that a number of times when I talk about let's do the math. And the industry, almost universally, the energy industry in the U.S., has said much that same thing. Chris Wright's own company that he just left, Liberty Energy, in its annual report and in its 2025 outlook, came right out and said that they're still all about capital discipline and making sure that they don't start losing money. And I don't know of a single energy company that has publicly said that they're going to fall on their sword, go out over their skis, add productive capacity that the market doesn't necessarily need, and drive the price down just to fall on their sword to make President Trump look good. Don't hold your breath for that to happen. So, you know, going forward, I think oil at $70 a barrel is a good bet. I think natural gas at $3.20 or $3.30 an MCF is great. I'll also add, and I'll repeat this theme again in the coming days, that I think a lot of the better Canadian stories for our neighbor to the north are screaming buys going forward. You know, they've still got their own political mess to get through up there. But once they do that, and I think that once some of the more heated rhetoric, and I think some of the, you know, approach of President Trump to Canada is frankly not helpful to the whole situation. You know, the fact of the matter is that we cannot do without that 4.5 million barrels of oil. We get most of it from Alberta and that area that our refineries use to make refined products in the U.S. We cannot replace that today. We won't be able to replace that level of oil production in the U.S., I think, in the entire 4 years of Trump's term, to truth be told. So look, I think that increased demand, supplies that are still constrained and not, you know, maybe some cases barely keeping up with the growing demand, I think you have to love old energy. Number three, And this is going to take us into my discussion that I recorded actually yesterday with Curtis Moore of Energy Fuels. Uranium at the current price, and I'll say it again, I said it in a couple of contexts recently, among other things on my YouTube channel and on this podcast channel with my discussion with Scott Melby of UEC. Uranium right now at $70 on a spot price is every bit as bullish a story as it was when the commodity itself bottomed a few years back at a bit under $20 a barrel. Chris Wright is absolutely correct that nuclear energy is going to be in the ascendance along with natural gas one of these days. When you combine the two, that's going to be the strong majority, I believe, of all of our electricity and power grids, you know, supplied production in the U.S. is going to come from natural gas, number one, nuclear energy, number two, much more so than what we see today. Now, Energy Fuels, what was holding them up in the market, I think, for a while, and I've been in this story as, you know, my longtime subscribers and followers know, for quite a while. You know, we've made several times our money already on Energy Fuels when you look at its current share price. But I think that that's nothing compared to what's coming. Frankly, in comparison to a couple other production or near production stories in uranium, UEC being one of them, which percentage-wise has done quite a lot better, especially in the recent past, than Energy Fuels has. Energy Fuels became somewhat of a confused story in the markets at the same time that they were kind of put on ice somewhat over this long-running controversy, if you will, with the Navajo Nation down in northeast Arizona over largely the ability to use the roads through the Navajo Reservation to haul ore from their Pinyon Plain mine, the highest grade conventional uranium mine almost on the planet. It's as high grade or higher than a lot of the stuff in the Athabasca Basin in Saskatchewan. And once they get this thing going, you know, in the next year or so, they can be up to 500,000, maybe approaching a million pound production annualized, as you're going to hear Curtis talk about. But, you know, the issue has been with the Navajo Nation that there's been some bad blood, and understandably so, for a lot of years. Not against Energy Fuels per se, because they didn't do this, but when you go back years ago, a lot of uranium mining was done in and around the reservation. A lot of mines were left open. They were never reclaimed. A lot of old low-grade ore is stockpiled, still sits on the surface there. I'll let Curtis tell you more about the nuts and bolts of that story. But anyway, long story short, that confusion around when Energy Fuels was going to start to do a lot of uranium production itself, number one. And number two, I think the market not really understanding the other major component now of Energy Fuels, and that is as a mineral sands and rare earth company. Several months ago, I spent a lot of time on a video interview with Curtis talking about that. You'll find that on my YouTube channel if you go back. It was last May time frame, and we'll have to update that again soon as well. But that, I think, has kept some people kind of on the sidelines until they get their head around just how robust a business the mineral sands and rare earth processing is going to be. Energy Fuels, through their White Mesa Mill in Utah, is pretty much the only place that can process rare earth ores the way that they do right now. There's a second one that's finally up and coming, but they're a very, very important part of America's game plan to take back control of our own destiny in that area as well, not just uranium. And I think that's been misunderstood. But now that we've got the Navajo issue put to bed, a landmark agreement that was signed by, I mean, you had the EPA involved, you had the state of Arizona, the governor there, you had Energy Fuels involved, you had the leadership of the Navajo Nation. It's a win-win situation for everybody, as you're going to hear Curtis explain. Now, before I bring him on, real quick here, of course, on the screen is the contact information. If you're listening to this, rather, by audio, the contact information and website and everything for Energy Fuels will be in the notes to the program, so make sure to visit them. Make sure, of course, to read all of their various disclosures and so forth, because, of course, Curtis and or myself may be making some forward-looking statements that might pertain to Energy Fuels. We want you to know about that as well. But anyway, this is a story that just got cleaned up a lot. I think investors are going to be re-embracing energy fuels again, and I would suggest that you do as well, whether you're already an investor in it or contemplating that. Real quick before I bring him on, I want to play just over a three-minute video. The audio version is not going to be lost on you if you're not able to, quote, watch this right now. But it's just a little bit of a background of the Pinyon Plain Mine in Arizona, which, again, is an extremely high-grade underground mine with a lot of production potential. And now, within days of recording this, Energy Fuels, following this landmark agreement with the Navajo Nation and everybody else involved, all the other entities, is going to be hauling and starting to process ore again and selling uranium from its Pinyon Plain mine. So sit and watch this or listen to this, and in a few minutes I'll get right into Curtis.
In our global pursuit to provide reliable energy while combating air pollution and climate change, nuclear has emerged as a beacon of hope. Clean, efficient, and reliable, nuclear power is fueled by a naturally occurring element found in the Earth's crust, uranium. For too long, our reliance on foreign uranium, specifically Russian, has left us in a vulnerable position. It's time for a pivotal shift. The United States stands on the cusp of an energy revolution, with domestic uranium at its core, propelling us toward a secure and sustainable energy future. You can forget outdated notions about operations of a half century or more ago. This is not your grandfather's uranium mine. In the U.S., the uranium mining industry has transformed and is now defined by unparalleled standards in technology, environmental protection, and worker safety. At the forefront of this transformation is Energy Fuels Pinyon Plain Mine. The entire site takes up only 15 acres, and the mine shaft itself is about the size of a shed. But despite its size, this little mine is set to have a big impact on fulfilling our nation's clean energy requirements, with the capacity to power millions of homes while drastically reducing carbon emissions. The Pinyon Plain Mine is a unique geological formation known as a breccia pipe, in which uranium is found in a naturally occurring vertical deposit. By targeting the concentrated uranium in the deposit, we preserve the surrounding ecosystem and keep our footprint to an absolute minimum. Breccia pipes come with their own natural protections that prevent contamination of the watershed and the environment that Energy Fuels supplements with our own additional layers of protection and monitoring. Don't just take our word for it. The Pinyon Plain Mine has been studied by scientists and regulators for decades, and it will be the ninth such deposit mined in northern Arizona since about 1980 with no adverse environmental impacts. To extract the uranium, first we sink a shaft straight down and then horizontally to access uranium deposits at various points. And what exactly does the uranium ore we extract look like? Well, it's just a rock that is mildly radioactive that contains about 10 to 20 pounds of uranium per ton of ore. The uranium we extract is not explosive and it doesn't glow green. It's actually not even that hazardous when compared to other materials routinely handled by industry. It starts underground as big rocks that we break down into smaller rocks, which are then brought to the surface and loaded onto a truck, tightly covered, then transported off-site for processing. We have strict protocols in place in the highly unlikely event of a spill, but in general terms, the ore would be scooped up by workers and loaded onto another truck and sent on its way with nothing harmful left behind. Compare that to hazardous liquids like diesel fuel and industrial chemicals, which represent a much greater safety concern and are transported across the entire country, including Arizona and the Navajo Nation, every day. Once we've extracted the ore, the mine will be sealed and any residual uranium on the surface removed. Following a period of post-closure monitoring, all of the buildings and equipment will be removed. The site will be recontoured and revegetated, and it will be restored back to its original state. Within a few years, you won't know a mine was ever there. You will be able to recreate and enjoy it without worry. The story of Pinyon Plain Mine is one of innovation, safety, and progress. It's a story every American can be proud of. Join us on this journey towards a safer, cleaner energy future. By supporting domestic uranium production, we're not just powering our nation, we're securing a clean energy future for generations to come.
Okay, and back again with us is my old friend Curtis Moore. He's a Senior Vice President for Energy Fuels. Curtis, I'm glad you could get with me today.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Great to see you.
Well, you know, it's very, very big and very long-awaited news that you guys put out on the 29th, just over a week ago, what you're calling a landmark agreement with the Navajo Nation. which covers a variety of things that we're going to put a little bit, add a little bit more color to today. And it included what you got. We've got the state of Arizona, we've got the Navajo Nation, we've got energy fuels, we've got the EPA, a lot of different parties to this whole thing. It was a long time coming, wasn't it?
Well, I've been very closely involved in these discussions with the Navajo Nation. And the fact that we were able to come to an agreement with the Navajo Nation is honestly one of the prouder moments of my career. These discussions went on over about 6 months. Honestly, we could have told them to, honestly, just keep trucking without their consent. But we felt like it was going to be much in the long-term benefit for Energy Fuels to sit down and talk to them, to listen to them, and to see if we could come to reach a reasonable accommodation. And I'll tell you, right from the get-go, they told us flat out, "We're not here to stop you," which we were very encouraged by. And I think over the course of those several months, we built up a lot of trust, not just with them, but also us with them, but them with us. And I would say right now, it's a very cordial relationship with the Navajo Nation, which is pretty spectacular, given the history of uranium mining on the Navajo Nation back in the 40s and 50s and 60s.
Well, and that's kind of where this whole story, I think, started too, Curtis. And for those of you listening, early on in this country's nuclear energy life, most all of the uranium mining was done in and around the land of the Navajo Nation out in the Four Corners area of the Southwest U.S. Some of it wasn't done according to what we would think would be good standards today. And thus, there are what, hundreds of millions of tons or more
Yeah,
of
millions of tons, millions of
millions of
tons.
tons of waste rock and whatnot that's there, a lot of it laden with perhaps some uranium that can be recovered. And that's been, of course, a bone of contention, I think, for a while, is that I think the Navajo Nation, to be fair, had a jaundiced view of uranium mining and the government's handling of this up to this point. And you guys have always kind of been looming as a potential white knight, and you have in the past, on a test basis, taken some of this material up to the White Mesa Mill, haven't you?
I don't think that we've actually been able to take any. We had an agreement to take some right before COVID, but that kind of
That's
went
right.
away.
That's right. COVID stopped you. That's
It
right.
did. It did. But yeah, no, that back in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the U.S. uranium industry, I put in quotes, it was essentially a government weapons program,
Right.
where the government needed uranium, to counter the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And they were the only buyer. They were encouraging the mining of uranium. The only buyer for uranium was the U.S. government. And again, it's a little. I don't want to be too hard on those guys back then because look, they were trying to do the best they could at the time they were there, and trying to counter the threat of the Soviet Union. But you're right. They did not use methods that would be ex anywhere acceptable today. And there were a lot of mines that were just left behind. They were abandoned, and that's what they're called, or abandoned uranium mines, or AUMs. And I believe there are on the order of about 600 of these across the Navajo Nation. And there are many, many others, in the Four Corners region outside the Navajo Nation. They weren't the only ones that were impacted by this. But there are, I believe the EPA, U.S. EPA, has said there's on the order of 600 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation, many of which have not been cleaned up properly. And so you're right, they have a jaundiced view. They're very skeptical of this. Now, again, we're not trying to mine on the Navajo Nation at all. But we do have a facility, the White Mesa Mill, that is able to really step in and help, and in a lot of respects, just try to move beyond that legacy, because it's a sad legacy of environmental contamination and health and safety impacts that Navajo and a lot of other people suffered. We don't do things like that anymore, and so we're in a great position to be able to show them that that is the case.
So part of your deal that was brokered again by all the different people involved is that you're going to initially agree to process some of this waste that you're going to carry away, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So as a part of our agreement, we agreed to take 10,000 tons of this AUM waste for free. Now, it's we call it waste, again in quotes. A lot of this material actually has recoverable uranium in it. And so, it's really kind of ore from another perspective, ore for the mill, ore feed. But as you said, I think in the beginning, there's potentially millions of tons of this material across the Navajo Nation, of which we could take a lot of it. This could be it's probably going to be a long-term, cleanup effort. There's already, I believe, on the order of $2.5 billion that is set aside for about 10% of those mines. So you can see there's billions of dollars potentially at stake here. Now, of course, that wouldn't all come to us, but again, it's a great opportunity for the modern industry to work with the tribes and to clean up that legacy along with the U.S. government. They have a big role in this as well, and we're real proud to be a part of that.
Well, and in fact, that $2.5 billion that you mentioned, that's already been appropriated by the Environmental Protection Agency, correct?
Yes. And they have collected money from some of the successor companies.
Oh.
So there's been some settlement agreements signed by the US EPA, with some of the companies that, are the successors to those companies. And they're big names, I know Tronox, they entered into a big settlement with the EPA on these things. They were a successor company to those companies that were mining at that time. I think even General Electric, I mean, there's been some.
Wow.
Yes. So, there's so some of these companies are stepping up and providing, money for these cleanups. And again, at the end of the day, though, that none of this would have happened without the US government. So the US government is ponying up a lot of money for this too. So it's going to be a big long-term effort, probably decades long. And again, at the White Mesa Mill, we can take this stuff. And in fact, we can, process, we'd love to get more of the high grade stuff. A lot of this material is likely low grade stockpiles, where if you
Right.
had a mine operating and you maybe mined some ore that didn't meet the grade cutoff of the local mill, well, you'd go set it aside. And I don't know what the grade cutoffs back then were, but 0.1, 0.15%, but there could be some, pretty good stockpiles laying around that we can process and recover that uranium out of it.
Well, just like in any other metal or mineral we want to talk about today, the technology has improved, recoverability has improved, and yeah, a lot of stuff that was set aside and wasn't run, you guys are going to be doing it for the first time.
Yeah, we think so. Yeah. And now again, we're not
Pretty
quite there
cool.
yet. We've agreed to take material for free. There's not a current agreement to take anything beyond that, although the Navajo Nation has asked us for some updated numbers about what it would take. We're licensed to take it right now. And there are some cleanup actions that are starting to move forward on the Navajo Nation. And I'm not sure that there's any good place to take that material right now other than the White Mesa Mill. And so I think
Right.
that's one of the big reasons why they're interested in working with us. I know Navajo President Boo Van Nigrin, he made it a campaign promise to his people that he was going to get cleanups going on at least two mines before the end of his term. And really, that can't happen unless you have a place to take the material. And that's really the White Mesa Mill. So I think that was a big motivation for entering into this agreement.
Sure. And I know that when you and I visited last several weeks ago before this agreement came out, obviously, you were mentioning that there was, you thought that this was looming, that there
Yes,
was going to be some
yes.
success. And you even remarked to me that when you were on your way to Washington for the president's inauguration, that you had some of the Navajo members with you,
Well, not with me, but I met
you
with
were
them.
part of that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. So, no, I'll tell you that we've developed some really great relationships. I think that they many of them, not all, but mo many have come to realize that, rather than being, the devil incarnate, like some of the activists believe us to be, we're probably one of their best friends. And we do things right, and we do things in the highest standards. We do things in the United States to the highest standards,
Sure.
and energy fuels in particular. It's almost obsessive for us how we try to just maintain the highest standards for health and safety and environmental protection. And I think that they've realized that. And again, when now it's time for us to show them what we do and what we can do. And I think that there's hopefully going to be some great partnerships, particularly on cleanups, well into the future.
Neat.
I don't think we're ever going to be mining on the Navajo Nation, nor do we want to.
Right.
Unless they want to, but we're a long way from that.
Yeah. Now you just by mentioning mining, you just segued into the next subject, and that is the Pinyon Plain Mine, because one of the other benefits of this whole broad agreement with the Navajo Nation is that they are now going to block any prior opposition to you transporting material through the nation from your Pinyon Plain Mine, which, correct me if I'm wrong, as far as any known resources in the U.S. right now, is the highest grade underground uranium mine.
Yes. I mean, it's
So,
the highest grade mine, period. Right.
period. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
you mentioned in the press release that I showed a picture of at the outset, that you plan to imminently restart production there and be able to transport ore. Give us a little bit of color on that as far as what the plans are, Curtis.
So we should start transporting ore again here in the next couple of weeks. We have a pretty, we have been mining. We have a pretty large stockpile out at the mine right now that we'll be able to get moved over to the White Mesa Mill. And again, we could have been transporting the whole time here, but because these are federal highways, and this is all governed by federal law, but we felt like it was important to get the consent of the Navajo Nation for this and to come to a real win-win, which I think will benefit all parties going well into the future. But yeah, no, it's a great high-grade mine. We're mining out there. We've got contracts to deliver that material into. I mean, there's been a little bit of weakness in the spot price of uranium these days, but we've locked up most of this material into contracts, and so this is going to be a great mine, and it's probably going to be the largest producing uranium mine in the United States over the next few years here. Just because, I mean, it's going to be on the order of 500,000 to 1 million pounds per year for the next few years, which I don't think any other mines in the U.S. that I'm aware of are going to get to that level.
Well, not quite yet. I mean, a few of my think are going to work up toward that, but and that there again is another issue I want to get to in a second. But just to finish up real quick, so you've already got ore stockpiled. You're going to be sending it within the next couple of weeks or so up to White Mesa, and up until now, I know that you've not really had a lot to say about the uranium part of it. Of course, as we covered in a video that you and I did several months ago, and in the other material I put out on energy fuels, you guys have built quite the rare earth related juggernaut these days too. We're going to have to get back to that again one of these days, sooner rather than later. But now, are you going to be in a place to give a little bit of guidance as far as what your plans are for uranium production again?
So we're going to be releasing our financials here in the next few weeks, and so I would imagine we'll put some guidance out on that regard. By the
Okay.
way, I like how you use the word juggernaut on the rare earth stuff, because honestly, that is what it is. People don't get it yet, but it is a
Well,
juggernaut.
no, they don't, and I think it's confused people as much as anything because I of course you and I have known one another for a decade or longer, and you were always a uranium company, and now you're filling in this other part of the U.S. critical metals and minerals food chain, and that's important for people to get. I've said in several contexts recently, and you've been living this every day, especially in the recent past, that in our lifetimes, we have not enjoyed a U.S. administration that's going to provide as much of a policy tailwind for our own extractive industries and our own energy as what the Trump administration is going to give us now. It's not the whole piece, it's not the whole puzzle, but the broad policy and permitting and regulatory framework, I think, is going to be great. And but sticking with the uranium theme for right now, and we'll be looking forward, of course, to the guidance that you put out with your financials and or afterward. How are you seeing things unfold? I mean, we've got a situation where last spring, the Congress voted and President Biden signed an eventual ban on Russian uranium imports that would take effect in 2028. And as many of us mused at the time, Russia a couple of months ago said, well, if you feel that way, why wait until 2028? We'll stop selling it to you now. And so China, kind of through the back door, they're the ones still supplying us. It's probably Russian uranium, at least to some extent. They're supplying enriched uranium. But that's going to be put to an end, I think, sooner rather than later. So you're really in the catbird seat because there's only a handful of companies, yourself being one of them, that's going to be able to step in and start filling some of this uranium need. So what are you hearing right now, in these early, admittedly early days from the Trump administration as to what kind of a role they're looking to you guys to play here?
Not a lot yet. I think they're still, going after some of their, higher priorities, right now. But as you point out, I think being a U.S. uranium producer is highly strategic, especially under this administration and his America First policies. So, as you pointed out, we have a Russian uranium ban, but the Biden administration DOE was offering waivers to that ban, so it really wasn't a ban. There was some indication that there was maybe some circumvention through China. I would say it wasn't a lot, but it was growing, and it's certainly something we want to make sure, we don't just trade, dependence on Russia for dependence on China for enriched uranium.
Sure.
Again, we'll see what actually comes about. We know that the Trump administration is supportive of nuclear. The new energy secretary, I mean, he's a nuclear guy, so So I think that you know we're very excited about what's to come because you know there's a wonderful opportunity here for the U.S. to regain our leadership in that in the nuclear fuel
Right.
cycle.
Now, in addition to the Pinyon Plain mine in Arizona, you've got several other projects. Can you tell us if any of those are going to be coming back online in a bigger way?
Well, you know, we've been mining at our La Sal complex, two mines out there. Those are going very well. We're looking at bringing our Whirlwind mine online here. I mean, we're getting that ready to go, getting our Nichols Ranch project ready to go. You know, but again, the price has been showing a little bit of weakness here, and so we're not going to bring those online in the face of this kind of weakness. But we're getting ready to restart very, very quickly if and when those prices come back, and we can you know place that material into contracts. So yeah, no, we're I think in a in as good of a position as any U.S. uranium miner out there right now. You know, again, we had that little hiccup. I call it a hiccup. It was kind of a voluntary hiccup with the Navajo Nation. But now I think it has come to a point where we're in a much, much better position vis-a-vis that mine. And I think that you know, getting the at least you know the partnership, a nascent partnership with the largest, most populous, probably one of the most powerful tribes in the United States, I think is a really great, great outcome that now it's time to live up to our promises.
Oh, I agree, because you would never have wanted a situation where you were going to be defiant and say, well, we'll just ship this stuff anyway, we have a right to, and then you get in bigger arguments and somebody gets
Yeah,
their.
we could have done that, but
It's you're so much better off now going forward
right.
cooperatively. And I think too, and I hope more of this comes your way, but when you've got the EPA that has got a budget for this, there's going to be other you got yourself a front row seat now with the Navajo Nation,
So
and now it's a cooperative one
it is
rather than
exactly.
something different.
Now, and again, this cleanup work, it's not going to be a huge business for us, but number one, we're doing our part to clean up the past, and number two, it should be a nice little source of cash flow for us moving forward, we hope. So
Well, it should, and whoever knows, what that might lead to, that'll be pretty neat to see. So, all
thank
right,
you.
great story, great update, and folks, those of you who have been a subscriber to the National Investor for a while, of course, we're in at Energy Fuels at way lower prices than this, so we're all happy. But notwithstanding the pullback we've had in uranium, where we peaked, it was $106 a pound, I think. A little over a year ago, or about a year ago. Now we've been around 70-ish, give or take a little bit, a pound. But
Still not a bad price. I mean, it's you know,
no.
if you'd told me 2 years ago the price would be $70 a pound, I'd be you know jumping up and down doing cartwheels. But
Well, that's
because look,
true.
for a mine like Pinyon Plains, $70 is just fine.
That's a nice number.
honestly, not a lot of companies can say that. But a
No.
lot of you know, $70 isn't great for a lot of these guys trying to come online right now.
No, but I'll tell you, I've said this to other people as well recently that I'm thoroughly convinced that at $70 now, the overall sector looks just as bullish to me as it did when uranium bottomed at just under $20 a pound on a
Oh
spot
yeah. Oh,
price.
it's oh the long-term fundamentals are phenomenal.
It's the demand situation just keeps growing and growing and growing now with data centers, with AI, with just the overall embrace, really, too, of nuclear energy in the world. There is not a single energy or extractive theme in the world that has got the tailwind that uranium and nuclear energy do right now that virtually everyone is on board with.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would also encourage people to not pay too much attention to the spot price. It's a small market. It's easy to manipulate and move around just on some small transactions. And it does happen. That does happen. Track the long-term price, and which is $82 a pound right now. That's a much greater, better indicator of where
Well,
the market.
and the prices for the enriched products in a couple of contexts, which unlike the spot price, which pulled back 30 plus dollars a pound from its all-time, those continue to hit all-time highs,
Great point. Great
the
point.
enriched
Great
prices.
point.
So it tells you just how tight the market is going to be going forward. And again, I think that this is a great story, and folks, especially when you've got a made in the U.S. story on uranium like Energy Fuels, it's far from too late to take a position. I mean, this and frankly, I think because of some of the market's misunderstanding of exactly what you've got with your rare earths business now as well,
Well, and honestly, the mineral sand business. I mean,
and that too.
we've built a rare earth juggernaut, the mineral sand juggernaut. Shoot, even the medical isotope stuff we're doing right now could become a juggernaut in and of itself. So,
right. And so you guys, when you add all of the sum of the parts, I think you're still quite undervalued and got a great history ahead of you, or a great story in front of you, just as I said with the spot price uranium itself. So, Curtis, thanks much, folks. A reminder, I'll put it up again. Make sure that you visit Energy Fuels website, follow them on social media. Get to learn more about them. Several months ago, Curtis and I talked a lot about their evolving mineral sand and rare earth business. We'll have to update that again one of these days soon, because here again, this is another big part of our nation's need for energy self-reliance that you guys are filling. And congratulations to you and Mark Chalmers, your CEO, and everybody there. So Curtis, until next time, thanks again for joining me. And I look forward to seeing you one of these days again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris.
All right.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to chris@nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.